Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Be Above Leadership's Blog Talk Radio show. I am Ursula and I'm here with my best buddy Anne and co-founder of Be Above Leadership. And today's call is on the topic of working with relational trauma in coaching and looking at why do it? And maybe also a little bit of, you know, what to do when working with this sort of a client in coaching, and sharing some of our insights and also some of the neuroscience of relational trauma. So working with relational trauma, my dear Anne, why are we talking about this?
I mean, there's so many reasons why we got into this. And I think I also want to throw in a definition so kind of know what we're talking about. But, I think the biggest piece is it is more and more, and I think many people have been echoing this as I've talked about trauma and I've been publicly speaking about it and things like that, is trauma is part of the human experience. And relational trauma is unfortunately all too common. So maybe should I give a little, I'll just read a little definition of, you know, what are we actually talking about?
Yeah, let's start there.
Okay, well, we have trauma. So trauma is really generally accepted to be occurring when a person is overwhelmed by events or circumstances and responds with intense fear, horror, and helplessness, and really extreme stress overwhelming the person's capacity to cope. And then relational trauma in particular, I think we focus there rather than trauma in general because it is the most common type of trauma. Mm-hmm. And it's an after effect of abuse, neglect, and suffering. Those who are betrayed by the people they loved, trusted, or relied on may encounter enormous mental and behavioral health challenges as they attempt to forge interpersonal connections and cope with life's many challenges, and that is something that we pulled off of a website that we thought really, really encapsulated that pretty succinctly.
Yeah, no, I really, really like that when a person is overwhelmed by the events or circumstances, when there is no way that we can make sense of the emotion and the impact, when we really feel that we are really very much afraid and feeling hopeless and helpless. So really like this definition.
And I think, you know, one of the reasons that we started looking at this really specifically in coaching is it's a continuum, you know. It ranges, and we'll talk about sort of the range of when we can work with it in coaching and when we really, the client needs a different modality. But I think one of the reasons for me, Ursula, is that so many of what I would call my clients' adaptive strategies, and we might even think of them as, saboteurs or limiting beliefs or things like that, I like to think of them as adaptive strategies from early in life, come from trying to manage a dysregulated person in their early childhood environment.
Yeah, and, this is so important in terms of coaching because we work with people's emotions and all that. And then again, to your point of why would we sort of dive deeply into this subject, because it is all around us, absolutely. The other thing that I find another big why is I feel that people have a not clear relationship with what a dysfunctional relationship actually is and what trauma is. For example, in organizations, it sometimes gets sort of brushed aside as, oh, this is just how people are.
Yeah.
And they don't realize it's actually traumatic and dysfunctional.
Well, and we have had that in our, so we do a trauma coaching and trauma program. And I remember one of the people, this has actually happened a number of times with people that have come into the program, and they've been attracted to the program because they're saying, I want to learn about this as a coach, and I want to be able to help more people. And as they've gone through the program, the big aha and really, oh my God, moments where they get a little dumbstruck and say, oh, this is describing my boss, and that is why I felt so terrible. We had a woman in the program for 20 years, worked for someone who could probably fairly be described as having strong narcissistic traits, and she said, you know, I never understood it. Now I understand it. And this is not just one person. This is again and again where it's like, oh, that's why I could never get anywhere with that business partner. Oh, that's why every time I go see my mother, I come home and my nervous system is on edge. And they didn't know. So I think your point is really, really important, Ursula.
Well, and you know, this leads me sort of to saying that because, I mean, I didn't know what was going on before you and I were diving into, you know, what is going on here with this person and let's do some research and what's going on here. I didn't know what certain people were doing and the impact it had both on me as well as on clients. So this whole educational piece that, as you said, is also in our program is sort of another huge light bulb. It seems here is what you need to know. Here are the facts.
Well, and even sometimes that comes down to that there is a distinct vocabulary. And you know, I think for many of us, we have sort of a, either we didn't really see it or we're sort of like, yeah, I never really liked that. You know, I never really liked that old boss, or I don't get along with that aunt or whatever, but we don't know why. And I'm reminded of a guy that I worked for right before I became a coach and I was working as a consultant, and this guy hired me, and oh my God, what I now know was something called love bombing. He idealized me. You are going to be the best thing that ever happened to this organization. You, I mean, you're just ready to run and I'm going to support you. And then nothing ever got done because he was just a blowhard. And very narcissistic. And when I kind of saw through him and was kind of like, you know, I don't really think that's the best way to approach it. Well, then I got no attention whatsoever. It's like I didn't exist. And I now know there's language for that. Love bombing, idealization, devaluing, being put down, discarding. And then I went through it. All I knew until I had this vocabulary was, oh, yeah, that guy was just kind of a jerk or kind of an idiot.
Yeah.
But now I see he was doing the very predictable pattern. And if I had stayed, I would have probably ended up feeling really, really bad about myself. But luckily, he was so ineffective that nothing ever got done and we never got any contracts. And so I just left because there wasn't enough work. Thank God.
That was lucky. That was lucky for you, which, you know, you're describing the impact of some of these behaviors on a person. And maybe this we might want to sort of highlight a few of those in a moment. But I was just thinking about another why we are so passionate about this topic. For me, I sometimes have clients that are looking for purpose and vision and mission, and they're trying to figure out who they are in the world and what their purpose is. And I can coach them and coach them and coach them and coach them with all my tips and tricks and coaching tools and skills, and there is no movement. And I knew what was happening to the brain in terms of trauma and the impact on the brain, I often was sort of flabbergasted and thought like, Ursula, like, what are you doing? Why is nothing happening? Well, now I know that people that have been impacted by relational trauma often cannot find their way to purpose and vision.
Well, if you've been devalued, and especially in, at any point in your life, the brain you know, we're trying to get along, we're trying to survive, we're trying to, you know, work with the people around us, whether that's an intimate partner, in a job, or in your family of origin. And if you've been given messages that you are, you know, not valuable and you're stupid and all of that, it's very hard to, you know, come to this place where you feel very empowered and clear. And, you know, it's really common for people that have been through this kind of, we call it relational trauma, this kind of abuse, to really not even know where to look to figure out what they want, because it's not been part of their schema. So I think that's really good, and it really highlights a point, just to go off for a little bit, which is that why do we train coaches in relational trauma? Because it sometimes is what comes up, even though people didn't come into coaching saying, I need to resolve my relationship with my father, right?
Yes.
But as
yes.
we're doing other work, it becomes quickly clear there's something else hanging out in the shed with us.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
that's why we're not getting anywhere. And so at a minimum, to be able to recognize the patterns, and sometimes this may be that we say, and the client, and we'll talk about this in a minute, I want to talk a little bit more about why, but then we'll talk about a little more about how. But sometimes the client is, you know, basically stable enough and we can keep going. And then I know we have both had incidences where client has come looking for purpose or career change. We have uncovered in the coaching that it is actually not that they don't know, you know, what they want to do. They can't get there because they've got unresolved trauma, and we've referred them to therapists. I think we both have done that. So
yeah, because I didn't know how to support them anymore. I didn't know what was going on, and why could any, it's sort of an interesting thing, why could anybody be so stuck in terms of a topic that was so clear to me, and not knowing what else to do for the client was really, really not helpful to them, and certainly not helpful for me as a coach.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a couple of other reasons why we decided to start working in this area more intentionally and training coaches in this area, and there's a really practical one, which is there are not enough people trained to work with relational trauma. People, I say that intentionally because I thought when I came into this field, well, you know, the therapists all know what to do, and so I will just refer them off to a therapist, and they'll be all taken care of. And then I was able to connect with one of the leading therapy experts in the field, this woman named Dr. Romani, and had, you know, worked with her for a bit on some stuff for the ICF, and she told me therapists aren't trained in this either. So they
mm-hmm.
don't actually know what to do, and many of them, unless they get specialized training, don't know. And then the other thing she told me is there aren't enough therapists. So
yeah.
there are simply not, and this, you hear this again and again in the relational trauma abuse recovery field, is there is not enough support for people that have gone through this. And so we as coaches, I don't think ethically we can just say, oh no, that's the therapist, you guys take care of it. Number one, they don't know what to do either. Number two, there's not enough of them.
Well, and, you know, that brings me to our sort of perspective and looking also towards the International Coach Federation. And even there, the International Coach Federation, in terms of, you know, their guidelines, they do say that other modalities, coaches that are trained in certain areas, like, for example, equine-assisted coaching, nature coaching, various forms of energy coaching, that is an acceptable way to work with clients. And so with the right education in terms of trauma, I personally feel competent to support my clients depending where they are in terms of their healing journey.
Well, and I think this really points to something that I was really struck by. The International Coach Federation, for those of you who are listening who are coaches, you know, they have a white paper on, I think it's called Referring a Client to Therapy. And I was really struck by that they say again and again, a therapist or a coach specialized training. And so I do think that's important to highlight, which is that I would not recommend that any coach, you know, with it's particularly, you know, without a lot of coaching experience, you know, just dive right into trauma because Anne and Ursula said, yeah, go for it. Coaching's great.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Please don't do that. Because the truth of the matter is we can make some huge mistakes, as can therapists, if we do not have specialized training. And so there are some real kind of do's and don'ts around this. And I remember when I first was recovering from my own relational trauma, which is part of the, and I've been very public about that, and it's certainly part of the inspiration here. One, a coach friend of mine, you know, with nothing but the best intentions, you know, got all excited and asked me, you know, how was this part of my story? How was this part of my pattern and all of that? Well, at the time, I was dealing with fundamental issues of safety, literally. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know where I was going to live because this was, you know, pretty bad. And this was not useful. And I think coaches need to understand there's a trajectory to when you bring up what kind of conversation in coaching. And yes, we sort of, what's interesting about that story is at the time I did have enough self-possession to say, not helpful. I am not answering that question right now. That is not a good question for me right now. But 2 years mm-hmm. later, we were having coffee and she said to me, and I'm really sorry. I realized I made a big mistake when I asked you that question. I'm really, really sorry. So it's fine. Ask me now. Ask me now.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great freaking question. I love that question. Absolutely. I talked to you all day. I've learned so much because now I'm making sense. And one of the things in terms of coaching is that's actually a wonderful place along the healing journey that I do think coaching is really helpful is when a client is now not in crisis and they've, you know, done some exploration, however they've done it, and then to come and say, oh, well, let's look at those patterns. And even questions like, what were the weird, you know, strange blessings out of this? I love those questions, not right away. And coaches need to understand the subtleties of this rather than just jumping right in, because that question does not work when someone's trying to figure out if they're safe.
Well, and absolutely, and to your point, you know, coaching is therefore well suited to have the appropriate client. And it's not so much maybe the appropriate client, but more clients at the appropriate stages of their healing journey, depending where
yeah.
they are. Then the
yeah.
self-reflection of learning can be so useful. I had a client who was looking at a career change and had applied for a position in an organization. And when we sort of were diving deeply into it, she realized that she was applying to a similar organization with similar challenges,
mm.
or rather similar dysfunctions, than two of her previous ones. So
yeah.
you know, she was ready to look at, oh, this
yeah.
is a pattern. And I'm wondering
yeah.
why I'm attracted to these kinds of dysfunctional bosses. What's going on here?
Totally. Great question. Well, you know, and I remember once, and I was on some sort of coaching, you know, Q&A forum, and this is a question that is so big for coaches. What's coaching? What's therapy? And someone very confidently weighed in, well, you know, these are the sort of topics we talk about in coaching, and these are the sort of topics that are therapy. And if my client mentions X, Y, Z, you know, it's immediately therapy. And I thought, what a limited way of looking at it, because for me, it is not the topic. It is the approach to the topic. And so I think what you and I have really arrived at as a one of the most fundamental screens in terms of whether we'll work with a client around helping heal from relational trauma or even while they're in it is, to what degree can this client be an observer of what is going on, and to what degree are they drowning in it? And
yes,
that has been the most helpful way of looking at
yes
it for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is such a good frame, I think, not only for us as coaches, but also for the client. Is to say, what is the observer, and what does that feel like to observe this experience versus being in it? For the whole point of, how do you regulate these emotions that come up in this conversation? So that, you're absolutely
love
right,
that
has been one of the biggest sort of big ahas for me as well.
Well, and you're raising a really good point, which is something that I think certainly I have learned, the hard way in many years. Both Ursula and I have been coaches for over 20 years. So, learned this sort of the hard way, but that I sometimes see when I'm training newer coaches, not everyone, but occasionally, where the coach feels like they, almost figuratively imagine them putting on their, buttoning up their suit, like they have to have it all figured out and everything has to be well-oiled behind the scenes and they have to know and they have to be able to see, rather than, I've just learned that I can be a lot lazier and I can just say to a client things like, well, here's who I work with, you're telling me you've got, you're in a healing process from a really difficult relationship, or you're trying to figure out if this is a dysfunctional relationship. I actually get that a lot. And I'll just say, well, okay, here's who I work with. I work with clients who can stand with me in an observer state and kind of look at it and explore it and are able to do that without undue distress. It's okay if there's a little distress. It's okay if you cry. But I need you to be able to stay present with me while we're doing it, even if you're crying. So, does that feel like something you can do? I don't have to figure that out. To your point, I can just ask them.
But I do. So everybody who's listening, please do a rewind and just take a note of how beautifully Anne just put that, of saying, can you be with me, stand with me in this as we explore this together? And can you be an observer? Can you look at it with curiosity as we are exploring that? So it's such a great introduction
and
description.
And if you can't, and this, a couple of things. If you're not at that point, that's fine. But there may come a point where you're more at that point, in which case, reach out. And this is also the case where sometimes, particularly in the earlier stages of healing, I may be part of the team along with their therapist. But I'm still going to stay very transparent. The other idea that we use a lot, and we use it also transparently with our clients, and it comes from Dr. Dan Siegel, who I think originally coined the term of the window of tolerance. And do you want to talk a little bit about what that is, Ursula?
Well, you described it earlier on. It's where the client can stay in observer mind without being either so distressed that they get very agitated, or that the distress is so strong that they actually check out. And so that's the window of tolerance. There's either so much arousal that it goes into high agitation, or the opposite, which is, complete shutdown. And somewhere in there is this presence, is observer mind.
Right. And you may even want to, from a learning and growth and, neuroplasticity standpoint, you may even want to work with them on, pushing the edges of that in a gentle way. And so, but it's something I train my clients in. I talk with them about this. I say, as we're working together, we all of us, including me, have our own window of tolerance around stress. And so as we explore things, this is something I'm going to check back with you on, and I'm going to say, okay, you just told me, you just shared with me, you know, potentially something about your mother that was hard. How does it feel? Do you want to go further with that, or do you want to talk about something else? So you're always at choice. And what
yes.
Ursula and I know from a neuroscience perspective is that keeping a person absolutely in choice about what they want to talk about is a way of helping them manage their stress and their distress. And I've had clients say to me, yeah, I don't want to talk about that. And I'll say, that's great. Let's stay more in the present and let's look at that. Or occasionally say, you know, this keeps coming back, and I think that I would like to look at how that pattern is affecting me now. And it does feel okay to talk about that. But I'm only going to push a little because it's not helpful to take someone out of their window of tolerance because they what ends up happening is the brain gets overloaded with stress chemicals, and as Ursula said, either it shuts down or goes into hyperarousal. Either way, they are no longer hearing anything you're saying, and they're no longer able to process in a helpful way. So I am so pissed off, to be frank, with any kind of program that takes people, that stresses people out of their window of tolerance and puts them in this kind of deer-in-the-headlights place, because the neuroscience research says really a stupid idea for learning, really stupid.
Well, and
just shut people down.
It's quite frankly, whether we're talking about relational trauma in coaching or not, I think we all have our window of tolerance. We all have places where because of some emotional, you know, the emotional depth or whatever is alive for us in that moment, there's only so far we can go. And I think that's just very good coaching, is giving the clients choices and asking, whether they have undergone some trauma or not. And, you know, to the point,
absolutely.
It is also a myth. It's also a myth that none of us are traumatized. It's just on a continuum. To what degree, right? And
you
for
know,
how long?
One of our classes had this great metaphor. This is our friend Cindy. Oh my God, I love this. So, you know, she was using this to describe something else, but I think we can use this for trauma as well. It's like saying, what level of glasses prescription do you need? That if we think about a spectrum of trauma, and, you know, some people can see, you know, some people maybe they don't really need glasses at all, but if they really want to see the distance, they need binoculars. And some of us, you know, are basically, you know, can't see at all without glasses, and maybe some people can't see at all even with glasses, but that it's a level of, it's a level of disruption. It's a level of encountering dysfunction. You can have a wonderful family and still have been bullied at school. You know, that it is part of, unfortunately, I think what living in the modern world brings us is things that are stressful to the degree that they can be outside of whatever that current time ability is to process, make sense, and deal with. And that's what trauma is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, one, you were saying earlier on, one of the, you know, the impacts of being in a sort of traumatic relationship is that we start having self-doubt. We're not quite sure who we are. We've lost an inner compass. And this is another reason, I think, why coaching can be so helpful, because we have this overarching mindset of holding our clients naturally creative, resourceful, and whole. Now, this is, you know, sort of a maybe more of a CTI, the way CTI Coaches Training Institute words it.
No, it's part of, it's fundamental whether people, as you say, word it in that way, but it's part of, it's just part
yeah, I
of
think
our ethic as a profession.
I think it's part as a mindset of coaching is that, you know, our clients are that. They are creative, resourceful, and whole. And I think to just hold the client like that in this so connected relationship of coach and client, just to show them and let them feel it, what this is like to be held by one human, that in itself can be life-changing.
Really healing. And I think, you know, I've done such a deep a deep dive into this whole area, which has led me and you into studying psychopaths and cults and, you know, oh my God, like the things I've learned that sometimes I really wonder whether I should have. But one of the things that comes back as consistently being profoundly healing and part of the healing process is attaching oneself to purpose. And it's when it's also something I notice in clients that I'm working with is that a very common impact, and this is just building on what you were saying, of dealing with someone who's very, very disruptive, very dysregulated, very entitled, you know, we'll say very narcissistic, is that it can and often does take people to the lowest point of their experience into a place of hopelessness. And, you know, really like feeling so unable, you know, ineffective, et cetera. And so working with people to find a way forward, working with people to find purpose, working with people to understand and step into their own value and values, which is, that is what we are so well trained for in coaching. And I think the difference when we're working in trauma is just to understand it might be a slower process.
Yes.
And we may need to hold a lot of space, and as you're saying, a lot of love, a lot of care, but the consistent, you know, I see you as a whole person is, I think, over time very, very healing in this space. And I've had, and this is not to belittle any therapists, I think do really, really needed work, but I've also heard from a number of clients that they've, you know, at whatever point they've come to, that they've gotten more out of coaching than they did out of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the case that they came to coaching at a different point where therapy laid the groundwork where they were able to engage in this kind of conversation. So I think part of what you and I hold is there is a place, is we're not saying, you know, don't do therapy, but there is a place where sometimes people get accelerated growth and healing from being able to move into a coaching process, even with trauma.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, coaching is also essentially very practical, and that can also be very helpful when we find ourselves in situations like that. You know, there is action. There is, you know, do something, a little something, even if it's just reading an article about, you know, narcissistic abuse. All of that gives people, I think, also a form of control that they're doing something, they're moving forward in some little ways, which, again, can be hugely helpful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not that therapists don't do that, but it is very much, you know, we as coaches, boy, I tell you, it is, you know, even to this day, 20-some years after my initial training, you know, toward the end of the session, it's what are you, you know, okay, how are you taking what we talked about today into your life? And as we, you know, both of us started in coaching before we knew anything about neuroscience, which has been like the last 12 years or so that we've been engaged with that, 12 or 13 years. But what we've really seen is, that is the process of neuroplasticity. That is the process of, you know, I'm doing air quotes, wiring in really different habits, behaviors, and thoughts. It's thinking about it, talking about it, processing it is part of it. But actually putting it into action in your life is also a huge, huge part of that process. And coaches are really good at most well-trained coaches are really good at not just having it be talk, but having it be action as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we've talked a lot about, you know, what we do in coaching that is helpful. And either we talked about the window of tolerance, which sort of addresses when to work with this sort of trauma in coaching. Do you want to talk a little bit about the who? Like, who is the client, or what else would you like to unpack?
It sort of goes a little bit to the when, and it does make me, so, you know, who? It's a client who is able to be somewhat fascinating. I have a friend who once wrote a book called The Fascinated Observer, which I just think is, I just love that as a title.
Yeah,
so,
very good.
You know, I like my clients to be able to at least have moments of being a fascinated observer of this whole thing, to be able to, in the work together, depersonalize, because, by the way, relational trauma is not personal. It is a, you know, because of the personality trait of the abuser, it is, and I like to say, you know, people with the kind of personality trait that creates relational trauma, which is largely, you know, strong narcissistic characteristics, that they're equal opportunity abusers. They don't just, you know, you see it in other areas. This isn't about you. And so, you know, to be able to decouple that. So if I'm thinking about, sort of, here's what's coming up. It's like, when do I not want to work with someone? Let's talk about that. And I'll share my experience and I want to hear yours. Like, when would I not work with someone? Well, two things. One is they can't talk about it without feeling so bad that they need to cut the session short, or just, you know, talking about the weather, or that it is like almost impossible for them to be with it. And this can even come up with, I either see this when we're talking about, you know, any aspect of the trauma, or, you know, making a boundary or anything, and they just can't even, it's so distressing. Or the other place I see this, Ursula, is when we start getting into talking about their good qualities, their you know, their values and who they are, and they are so upset by me reflecting back what I'm seeing in them that they can't even be present to it, then I think, okay, there's other work that needs to be done here. So that's number one, and then I have number two, and then I want to hear from you. Number two is when they just keep, we used to call it in coaching school, circling Dallas. The plane is circling and circling and never landing. And so, you know, I think about a client who came to me for purpose and career change. She wasn't that upset by talking about anything, but she just wouldn't really go there. And it became very clear to me fairly quickly that she was trying to please someone other than herself, and there were a lot of internal messages that were not her core beliefs, but we couldn't untangle them, and she would not go into the knot, the K-N-O-T, with me to untangle it and to go, like, you know, who says the only important thing is this kind of career? Where does that come from? And do you believe that? And it would just be like, she would just be like, she would just skate off. It's like Teflon. And it was so frustrating that I did finally just say, like, this, you will never find the right career. And the only thing I can tell you is there's a bigger issue here that is deeper than what I can help you with. Get thee to therapy. How about for you? When do you not want to work with someone?
Well, certainly these two. I mean, the little helicopter in my case, trying to find a landing pad, which I often share with my clients, you know, when it feels like they've really been circling and don't find a landing place. that's definitely something that is somewhat of a red flag. And then your point number two, same thing. And then I remember, this is many, many years ago, I had a client who was referred to me. We had a really good connection. She was a lovely woman with a young family, you know, full-time job, stressed, and we worked on that. But what happened was every time she came to a call, and this happened over many, 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 many weeks, she was sad, she was tired, she was anxious, she was depressed. And then during the call, she would sort of get inspired lifted up, and then she would go back into her own life. And, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, she would come back at the same state, in the same state. And then I realized that there was nothing more I could do for her, and I did suggest therapy, which she took that advice, and I hope that it helped her. But what was interesting about that, I felt like I couldn't do anything for her, but in the very end, after she did take my advice and went into therapy, she said to me that my loving presence was what she needed at the time, even though she didn't move forward. So, you know, in some way I did something, but, you know, it wasn't enough to really help her make some substantial shifts.
It's, you know, the image that is coming to me, and I'm thinking about, you know, my own experience with this is it's, which I'm not sure how I totally feel about that, but there are times where I'm a bit of a life preserver. They're kind of hanging on.
Yes.
They're getting a breath.
Yep.
They're resting a bit. But the thing that I will find in that kind of client is, and I've had this with organizational clients, they come to me, they're feeling bad, they leave, they're feeling better, and then it doesn't really last, is that it is because it's sort of like, in our conversation, they've stepped outside into the clean air and they're breathing and they're like, wow, this is great. I can breathe. And they step back into whatever system they're in, whether it's a family system or a workplace system or sometimes a cultural system. And it's like they're walking into the smoking room at the airport and they're like, oh my God, I can't breathe. And now I have asthma. And it's like, not, you know. You're fine. We just, it's the system. And this is one of the reasons why if I get hired by an organization, I am very, very clear that I coach the whole person. I will coach about whatever is up for them. And if what comes up, and I have said this very directly to organizational clients, to the, you know, like HR is hiring me, whatever. If what comes up that it would be in the client's best interest to leave, I will coach them around that. Because sometimes
I have the same.
Right? It's like the person is fine if I can just get them out of the smoky room, for God's sake.
Yeah.
They'll be fine.
I like the image of the airport smoking room. That really, really, I can really see
barely,
you can't even see the people. It's just a great cloud of toxicity.
And then the client is going, why am I coughing so much? What's wrong with me? And then they talk with you and nothing's wrong with them. And they, you know, they have hope and they, you know, see their value. And then they go back in that damn system. And this is, you know, a big piece of it, and I think probably the biggest frustrating piece is that there are so many, I would venture to say, and I don't think this is unfair at all, that there are that the majority of the workplaces that people are in are dysfunctional. The majority.
I mean, and I think the higher the position, you know, once you get into C-suite, I think in the director manager level, there's still people can still sort of protect themselves in some way, you know, within a team system and can create some functionality and some connection there. But when you go higher up, it becomes harder and harder. Certainly, my experience coaching people.
Well, and you and I have seen something in that case that I'll just mention as an aside, that where I've had a really good leader, and like a good leader, like very well, you know, well regulated, thoughtful, smart. And they end up being, I call them, this is a client described himself this way to me once, that he was a bulldozer leader. And I said, "What do you? You're not a bulldozer." And he said, "Oh, no, no. I am clearing the way for my team. I am what is
yeah.
in between them
yes.
and the
yes.
toxic workplace." Now, what the problem is,
yeah.
two things happen there. If you are the one person who is absorbing all the toxicity, you're going to burn out, and it's also very likely you will be fired. Why? Because you're not playing the game of the organization, or you'll just burn out or get sick if you're taking all of it by trying to protect your team from what's really going
oh, yeah.
on.
Yeah.
And the other problem is, and the research is really good at on this, is that the higher you go, the more psychopaths and narcissists there are. Why? Because they like to be in control of things, and they know how to be charming, and they know how to, you know, put a good mask on, and God, I did some presentation on this, and I was looking at all the numbers, and it was like they're the ones who are also committing fraud, you know, and all of that.
Yeah.
It is so prevalent at the higher levels.
Yes.
If you're a good leader at the higher levels, man, being that bulldozer kind of in between
yeah.
the team, man, that's going to be tough. I don't recommend
yeah.
it as a strategy.
Yeah, no, and I have a couple of clients right now who are this buffer between the one level up and then the couple of levels down, and it takes a huge toll. You know, this whole thing, managing up and managing down, they're really squeezed in this very, very tight
yeah.
space, and it's very stressful. Okay,
yeah.
Well, so we have the who. This is who we, you know, are not wanting to coach, and that's pointing to, you know, what is who we are wanting to coach, which is, you know, clients that are curious and within the window of tolerance. And when working with this sort of trauma is also, I think, a little bit of a moving target, because I think that is linked to where the client is in terms of observer mind and window of tolerance.
Right. And it's also, you know, so in our program, we use a model that we just lovingly call the dawn to dawn model, you know, basically trying to understand where the client is and what they need at that stage of their healing, of their awareness. And we call it, you know, it starts with the dawn, because they often come into coaching with the dawning of awareness, like, hey, maybe it's not me. Maybe my boss is really like actually out to get me. Maybe the reason I don't want to like hang out with my mom is she's always criticizing me. Like there's some kind of dawning, or this
mm-hmm.
relationship, I don't feel good. Like, so they're kind of coming into awareness, and then, you know, it goes on from there until we call it dawn to dawn, because it's kind of dawn of a new day where the client is now saying, okay, how do I make sure this never happens again? And it's not a linear model at all. But I do think part of the training for working with relational trauma, and I shared this story earlier, is there are questions we might ask at one point in the process that are not as useful at another. And being tuned in and really sensitive to some of this. And let me give one other example. So when I was in coaching, about what's different about coaching relational trauma from just regular coaching. So when I was in coaching school, Ursula, and I'm sure you were told the same thing, it was hammered into me that, you know, do not let the client tell their story. You know, don't let the client
yes.
get into story.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's not about the story. What are you going to do? And, you know, what's important to you? And, you know, keep them out of the story. Well, in relational trauma, what I have discovered is I as a coach have got to have much more space for the story, because
yeah.
memory and processing gets very disrupted by the stress hormones and the stress impact on the brain. And memory can even be quite fragmented and unreliable. And if I just go into, it's not about the story, the client can be left very discombobulated. And I will find that I need to let them tell me their story a few times and maybe revisit it even later on, because it's actually it's like they've been scattered into, you know, like it's like a vase that's been broken and there's little glass shards all over the place. Telling their story is one of the ways they reconstruct themselves. And this is a bit of a talent, and it is to recognize, okay, it's okay. And you might have a coaching session where you think, what the hell was I even doing as a coach? Because I was just listening to their story. You know what? In relational trauma, that is often what is needed. Now, you go through six sessions and all they're doing is telling their story. Yeah, probably not. But you might have three where they're reconstructing. Yeah. They're finding little pieces that are like, wait. And often in the retelling, new memory may even come back. And so I give a lot more room, and I don't judge myself as a coach for this. And that would be a critical difference. What else would be a difference if we think about the how we're doing this, Ursula?
Well, definitely the story thing, and that is something that I have learned in a huge way in terms of my regular clients versus those that have gone through relational trauma is the narrative. And I remember even in coaching school, you know, people saying, oh, that's just your story, as if it were something that I had made up willy-nilly from, you know, it came out of nowhere.
Right.
You know, and here we do know that it doesn't come from nowhere. It was created by something, through something. And so the retelling, as you said, is putting the puzzle pieces together again and creating a narrative that people now can live with, rather than having these disjointed memories. The other thing that I have learned is patience, to really look at baby steps. I'm not pushing too hard. I'm not going to, well, what's your next step and what are you learning? But being a lot more patient and much gentler in terms of what does the client need to keep them in this window of tolerance from call to call, and also realizing that it goes up and down. They come to a call and they're all ready to move forward, and then two calls later, they're sort of back in the basement again.
Totally. I think that's really, and, you know, I will tell you, I get my own coaching saboteur around that, sort of going,
oh, yeah.
Am I earning my money as a coach? And, you know, have I done enough? But absolutely. The other thing, the third thing, there may be even more, but one of the other really big things why I think training in this area for coaches is so important is there are classic patterns. And I actually think it's sort of funny in a gross sort of way, because there are really classic patterns, and every narcissist and disruptive character I've ever met likes to think they're the most unique person in the world. And the truth of the matter is I have coached people everywhere from who are dealing with narcissists in Nepal to China to the U.S. to Canada to Germany, all over Switzerland, everywhere. They all have consistent patterns. And so, you know, as coaches, it's interesting because we're supposed to stay curious, and we're also not supposed to coach who's not on the call and all of this. Well, you need to know what the patterns and the predictability is, because, you know, it's classic that I'll have someone who decides to end relationship with narcissistic boyfriend, for example. Classic.
Yep.
And they've had it, and they've had enough. And so they tell the person, you know what, this just isn't working for me. And then the person comes back as so wonderful. And I'm so sorry. And tell me, what can I do? I don't want to lose you. And let's go to therapy. And I'm just... And they come and they say, oh, and it's all going to work, and he just needed a wake-up call. And I'm just thinking, Yep, well, this is pretty predictable. And it's an interesting challenge as a coach, on the one hand, to really want to believe in the client, and on the other hand, to know 9 times out of 10 it's nonsense, because that is exactly what a narcissist will do when you tell them that they're leaving. You know, and maybe they'll be the exception. And so, you know, that's that example in particular is a tricky one. There are better examples of where I can basically point out a pattern. That one's hard because I would love to believe that this person has changed. What I do tell clients in that instance, because I don't want to just be like, oh, give me a effing break. You're going to be back talking to me in about 6 weeks, if not less. But what I do say is take it slow. Don't make any major decisions. Well, give them, you know, let them prove it. And honestly, they probably need to prove it over a period of months, not weeks. And you just watch for the, you can give them the benefit of the doubt, but you, but I really, really want you to take it slow, because this is a classic pattern. Now, maybe your person is different. Maybe they're different. But don't decide, therefore, you're going to have a baby, or therefore, you're going to buy a house together. Go slow. And that's the best advice that I have. But that is a point where, as a coach who's informed in this area, I feel like I do need to give them a little advice. Well, and maybe I'm wrong.
And on top of that, and this is, you know, giving a little bit of a PR and marketing second here or two, is that the great thing about our program, because we have some tools and structures that can help the client be more patient, that can help the client identify patterns from a red flag list to the patterns that happen in these relationships.
Yep.
I mean, we have handouts and conversations. I mean, there is such good education embedded in the coaching that will help the client get more clarity on what is going on, and that will help them be more patient and watch for the patterns. So I think
absolutely,
that is such a gift.
Well said. Well said, and we probably need to wrap up here in a minute, but I would say you said this at the beginning, and this was true for both of us. 5 years ago when I got involved with a narcissist, more than 5 years ago, 7 years ago when I got involved with him, I did not know what to watch for. I did not know the patterns. I didn't know the vocabulary. I didn't know what was happening to me. And I think a big piece of what we want to do is not only, you know, help people heal from this kind of experience, but also prevent it. Prevent it. So as you said, they can recognize, oh, you know what? That felt really weird with that new boss. I felt like I was being love bombed. Maybe this isn't good. Or at least let me slow it down. Let me slow down. Is this new partner a good person, or are they just telling me, you know, are they idealizing me again?
Yeah.
You know, slow it all down. Recognize the signs. And I think that's a big help for the more we can see what's going on, the more we can prevent this kind of trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are at the end. So if you have enjoyed this episode, go and check out our website, beaboveleadership.com. And if you have any questions in terms of this topic or coaching topics in general, you can email either Anne or myself at beaboveleadership.com. We've also got a great YouTube channel with Coaching 101 Tips. So, once again, thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Anne. This was a very, very, very wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you.
Yes, you as well. I mean, it's just so, you know, sometimes learning about all of these things, one of the things it's done is it's just really made me appreciate the healthy relationships that I have, and you're the healthiest one I've got. So thank you, Ursula. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Take care. Bye-bye.